very old friend came by today, 'cause he was telling everyone in town of the love that he just found. And Marie's the name of his latest flame. He talked and talked, and I heard him say that she had the longest, blackest hair, the prettiest green eyes anywhere. And Marie's the name of his latest flame. Though I smiled, the tears inside were a-burning. I wished him luck, and then he said a goodbye. He was gone, but still his words kept returning. What else was there for me to do but cry? Would you believe that yesterday this girl was in my arms and swore to me she'd be mine eternally? And Marie's the name of his latest flame. Though I smiled, the tears inside were a-burning. I wished him luck, and then he said goodbye. He was gone, but still his words kept returning. What else was there for me to do but cry? Would you believe that yesterday this girl was in my arms and swore to me she'd be mine eternally? And Marie's the name of his latest flame. Yeah, Marie's the name of his latest flame. Oh, Marie's the name.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstud Show, the radio show about comics. We're broadcasting from lovely UBC, even though it's not lovely today. It's a miserable...
It's always
yet.
Lovely at UBC.
It's a beautiful day.
It's a beautiful day. It's a Vancouver day without the wetness. It's just kind of blah. So, Inkstud's radio show about comics. Our guests today are Chris Staros and Brett Warnock. Let's see if I got them both there.
Hey, you guys, I'm here. This is Chris.
Hello.
All right, we got you both.
Cool.
So I guess I should mention who these guys are, other than just random talking heads on the radio. Chris and Brett are both the co-publishers together of Top Shelf Comics, who are recently celebrating 10 years on the Top Shelf. Did that sound too cheesy?
No, that's good. Very accurate.
It's kind of a miracle in this industry.
It is. And let's jump right into how Top Shelf has stayed going for 10 years, and really it's pretty different publisher, I guess, now than what you originally started with. And let's kind of go through how you got to where you are today. So how'd you guys meet?
Well, Brett and I met on the convention circuit in the early days, and I guess in the early 90s, like 94, 95, we were both doing different things separately. Brett was putting out some very cool mini comics and a cool anthology called Top Shelf, even though his company at the time was called Primal Groove Press. And I was doing a fanzine called the Staros Report that kind of reviewed comics and picked the best things out there and told you how to order them via mail and how much money to put in for postage, a giant pre-internet artifact of publishing, you know?
Kind of like the fact sheet 5 of the comic book world.
There we go.
Very much so. And Brett actually wrote me a letter because I reviewed a lot of comics. He sent me some of his anthologies in a really cool letter introducing himself, and his letter really registered with me because I could tell Brett was a hep cat with an incredible design sense, but a guy with absolutely no attitude about comics. He just loved good comics no matter what they were. If they came from DC or Marvel or the indie thing, he was cool with it. And so we followed up with each other, and then we met on the con circuit and became friends in a eventually hooked up his partners in 97.
And what was some of the first stuff you guys got into publishing that, this is something we both agree, awesome, we got to put this out?
You mean pre-joining forces or post-joining forces?
Pre.
What? Yeah, let's go with pre, because you got the pre-anthology.
Okay, well, I had the, besides Chris doing the Staros Report, I was doing the anthology, and then, like Chris said, mostly mini-comics and Saddle Stitch stuff. In fact, the very, very last comic that I published, which would have probably been my swan song had Chris not come along, was the first perfect bound book, which means, you know, not with staples in it, but
glue
bound book. Yeah. It was top shelf number 5. And so that was a huge step for me. But again, that was 96, I believe. And I was out of money. That was 97. And then Chris fortuitously and very serendipitously came along and said, "Hey, you want to be business partners?" And I'm like, "Hell yeah."
Like a proverbial Daddy Warbucks.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
like
except
that.
We were two guys with no money. So Daddy's no bucks. Yeah. You know?
But Chris had all the business acumen. And actually what a lot of people don't know is that originally a guy named Chris Orr was going to be a third partner in this adventure. And Chris Orr, you may or may not know, was the guy. He didn't create the Small Press Expo, but he's the guy who took over like in the second or third year and really ramped it up and turned it into the must show of the year for indie comics. And when we came on, the very first book, I think, Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, well, we published Jose Manuber's Broken Fender, but the first book we did was Hey Mister Collection.
Yeah, the very first book we all decided, actually the three of us decided to launch with, was the Hey Mister After School Special by Pete Sigma-Garner, which was a collection of a lot of Pete Sigma-Garner's mini comics and first comic books. And we just thought a really good humor book would be the best thing to launch with, and we loved Pete's work. We were huge fans of Hey Mister. Unfortunately, we did three trades of Hey Mister, and Pete sort of retired from comics and isn't doing them anymore, but man, we would still love to be publishing that series.
I know, it's great.
I gotta just make a note that Hoshue is, we are broadcasting from Vancouver, so he is one of our local cartoonists.
We stayed at Hoshue's house. He's a man.
He's a gentleman.
He's a mensch.
Yeah.
And he's actually predominant in the Georgia Strait, which is our largest alternative weekly.
Yeah, I think he was on the design staff at some point.
Yes, I think he still is, maybe.
He still is, yeah.
Yeah, his work is fantastic. And the early Broken Fenders and Cicada, the graphic novel we do with this later, we love all those books a lot. He's got such an elegant style that's so touching and heartwarming.
Yeah,
when you
so
read his
human,
book,
no?
It connects so well, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, totally. Hell of a gentleman.
A gentleman and a scholar.
Yes.
So,
I think what else? We went, and then we did, like, we decided to publish one of James Kochaka's early books, like another, again, collecting stuff that he had self-published. I think it was Magic Boy and Girlfriend was another one of our early book. You know, and we actually, you know, we've always published comic books, Saddle Stitch comic books with staples. But even early on, and I'm kind of proud of this fact, Chris and I, we pretty much saw the writing on the wall, because we got started at probably, depending on how you look at it, the worst time to start a comics company or the best time. We started right after the collapse of the
mm-hmm.
industry.
Yeah.
And we kind of saw the writing on the wall of, you know, should we serialize this as a 4-issue miniseries and then collect it? And early on we decided, you know what, screw that, let's just go straight to collected editions. Let's just do original graphic novels, because we're going to lose our shirts on the Saddle Stitch books, and how are we going to survive if we're losing money twice?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the graphic novels, we very quickly realized, were items that had a much longer shelf life. Comics tended to die on the shelves a couple of weeks after they were out, but graphic novels could be perennials. And also, as the book trade started to open up to graphic novels around 2000 and beyond, then you had a chance to sort of double your market, so to speak, on a graphic novel, while the comics would strictly be limited to the direct market.
Mm-hmm.
So we still do comics from time to time, because it's appropriate for whatever the project is, and because we still love to do them. But for the most part, we're a graphic novel house, you know.
So when you started publishing stuff, like, what direction were you hoping to go in with publishing? Because, I mean, for people that do know comics, I mean, there's Fantagraphics and Strong Quarterly, and it seems like you guys are a different element, still covering alternative comics, but it's not the same. Is that...
Yeah, every one of the indie houses, Fana, DQ, us, and Oni, Slave Labor, and everybody else, has a distinctive house style. Sometimes it's hard to pinpoint what that is, but you know it when you see it. You know what these guys do. And the nice thing is that all of us have carved out a slightly different niche for ourselves, and people can expect slightly different things from us. The books that we've published have really been the intersection of Brett's and my personal tastes, and they tend to line up along things that are kind of cartoony. and that things that have a lot of subtext and heart and things that are rather unique and original. And those are the things that Brett and I tend to light up on when we both see them, and those are the kinds of books that we tend to publish.
Well, and I think that also, comparatively, I think you could say that our books are a little more populist than CD Fantagraphics and D&Q, and believe me, I have almost the entire line of Fantagraphics and D&Q books. Yeah. But I think they're more a little, they aim a little towards the more literary, you know, and we're more, I don't know, popular in
fun.
In the true sense, you know, like populist.
Yeah. Mm. I find that they also seem to concentrate more on things that are like cartoonists that are completely into the way that they are for now going to be doing comic books.
Right.
But you guys seem to pick up things when you can see a potential there as well.
Right.
Yeah, we tend to break a lot more cartoonists than the other publishers do. And we also work a lot more conventions. We attend and set up at 21 conventions a year where we're able to showcase those works of new guys and really push them out there and get cartoonists to show up and do signings. And so we tend to be people that tend to break more guys as well.
It's also funny that you mentioned that like there's sort of different house styles that you can see emerge from like publishers like Fantagraphics and Drawn and Quarterly and yourself. But the one thing I do notice is that all the books that I think are the best books are the ones that I always forget who published them because they're just so good. You don't even, you know.
Right.
Well, it is funny. I mean,
the house brand in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, the best compliment somebody can ever, you know, bestow on a publisher and say, I wasn't sure about the book, but I turned it over and saw your logo and bought it because I trust your brand, you know. But you're right. Most people are very loyal to creators. They're the stars. I mean, Marvel and DC had to learn that the hard way years ago. It was their creators that the people ended up ultimately being loyal to in a lot of ways. You know, they were the ones that really could make their characters shine in different periods of time. So guys like Alan Moore and Craig Thompson and Andy Runton and Jeffrey Brown, Alex Robinson and James Kochalka, and, you know, these the fans tend to go for their books very much so.
Yeah, I think the mainstream companies like Marvel and DC are finally just, it's only been recently, I think, that they've started to, even Marvel doesn't even seem like they're jumping on that too much.
I think they did for a while, and then they kind of stepped back and realized that movies make money and forgot about creativity.
Because DC's always been pretty good at, like, letting, if somebody looks like they know what they're doing and everybody likes it, they just give them, you know, almost carte blanche to do what they want. But Marvel still, it's like, I look like, why? What the hell are they doing?
Yeah, let's not get started with Marvel and DC.
Yeah.
Why don't we talk about George Bush if we're going to talk
about or movies or something. Yeah.
I'm gonna lose a nut here.
Yeah.
And just for people that are outside of Vancouver and interested in checking out Top Shelf stuff, you guys will be, Brett, you'll be this weekend at Stumptown.
Yeah, I'll be here.
And then on the East Coast in a couple of weeks, I guess you both will be at SPX?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah. I think at some point I was drunkenly talking to you guys last year, so it was a good time. So I kind of want to go into like some of the featured creators you guys got and brought on, because Eddie Campbell, I think, was one of your earlier, like, kind of bigger names in the small world.
And I do remember, actually, I think it was in the Staros report that you had that great interview with Eddie Campbell years ago.
Yeah, I mean, that's Eddie and I forged a friendship before the Staros reports via mail. And I remember when he got started with self-publishing, I think it was Dave Sim that sort of convinced him to take a run at self-publishing, and he started self-publishing the Bacchus series in comic book form. I think he put out about 60 issues before he finally called it a day on that. But because he was in Australia and he was publishing for primarily U.S. marketplace, he needed somebody to help him out. And I had started doing my zine. I had done the interview with him. And I had started becoming sort of a phone pal and pen pal with him. You know, this was even before we both had fax machines, for Christ's sake. And so he decided that he needed somebody to help him out, and I volunteered to be his sort of U.S. agent, and started doing a lot of conventions and handling all of his shipping and distribution for him, and kind of through Eddie Campbell kind of set up the infrastructure for how Top Shelf would be run before it ever became its own company with Brett.
Yeah, that was Chris called that, I think, was it Star House?
Yeah, back then the company was called the Star House, which was just an umbrella for me to represent people, and so I was representing Eddie Campbell Comics and also Gary Spencer Millage of Strange Haven, and, you know, a few different creators at the time and helping get their books to U.S. markets.
Hmm. What has been some of the new stuff that you guys have come across that really, like, I don't know, young finds that you've had that really blew you away and kind of happy to be able to, like, promote and publish this stuff?
One of the ones we're really the most excited about right now is our new Canadian find, Jeff Lemire. Brett, you want to talk about Jeff a little?
Yeah, Jeff Lemire, you guys know his work? His Zarek book was called Lost Dogs.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that, actually. I've heard about it.
It's over magazine size, and it's got, like, this big, like, 8-foot-tall, British-looking... Oh, I won't get into the details. Anyway, Jeff Lemire won the Zurich a few years back for this book called Lost Dogs, and it was very, very, very painterly in style. The art wasn't really quite developed to my taste, but the story is amazing.
Is that the one that's the large format?
Yeah, it's the magazine format.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I do remember that one.
It's got, like, a guy with a red and white striped shirt on it.
Okay.
And a beautiful, beautiful story. And so fast forward a couple years, and I received a submission. I think Chris and I both got the same submission for the book that we published called Tales from the Farm. And at the time, I was reading that. I remember I was on a road trip with my wife, and we were kind of reading while she was driving. And I was like, God, this guy's really good, but there's just something not quite complete with the story. Like, there's a couple holes, and I'm like, man, he's really good though, but I'm gonna have to turn this down. And ironically, when we switched places driving, my wife read it, and she doesn't read my comics hardly at all, but she had no choice. We're in this car, and she's like, I love this story. And to hear that from my wife was a big sign. So I was like, well, I'm still not gonna accept it, but that's a big thing. So I sent Jeff an email, and Chris and I do this often, with some really, really pointed, constructive criticism. And I said, I love this thing, but here's why it's not working. And then I just kind of forgot about it. And then, God, it must have been 8 months or even like a year later, I got another package from him, and he had addressed all those things that I was talking about, and it was like airtight. It was perfect.
Awesome.
And I was like, wow, this guy is very serious about his craft, because here he is taking a good thing and making it better. So we published Tales from the Farm, and I guess what it was about, I don't know, 6 or 8 months ago that he sent us photocopies of his next book in the Essex County trilogy called Ghost Stories. And you know, I love Tales from the Farm, but Ghost Stories is even just far superior. This guy's growth curve is insanely good.
Yeah.
And he's a pimp on the road too. He loves, you know, and you know, this really matters in today's marketplace. You see this in the book trade or with spam.
Mm-hmm.
The cartoonists who are out there and willing to really work hard and attend conventions and you know, do library conferences and whatnot, you know, that's really important in today's market to make someone's catalog sell.
Yeah.
He's a warrior, so we're really excited about this guy, and he's pretty new to the scene. So.
I actually noticed that it seems that the cartoonists that I've met that are the most that seem to get like a momentum going in a career either have like good business acumen, or they're married to somebody with good business acumen.
Yeah, well, they don't call it the small press for nothing, and you have to get out on the road and meet people to develop a fan base. It really makes a difference when your cartoonist is willing to help promote their own work and come to the conventions that you're setting up at. But also in Jeff's case, with Tales from the Farm and Ghost Stories, which will debut at the SPX, by the way, and The Country Nurse, which is the third volume, which will come out next summer, his work is so emotive. I mean, Jeff's power to convey emotion through just his images and through his incredible sense of dialogue and narration. He's really, really one of the great new cartoonists on the scene now, and everybody should pay attention to what he's doing, because his stuff is dynamite.
Yeah, he really understands, without trying to borrow from literature per se, he really understands literary illusions. You know, one of the reviews for his first book, Lost Dogs, compared him to Faulkner. You know, and I think there's some validity to that, because he's working on so many levels. Like Chris was talking about our love for subtext in our books, Well, he's got it in spades, you know.
Yeah, I remember reading something that Ridley Scott said when he said that making a movie is like making a 700-layer cake, where you want to get as many layers as you can in there.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's a really great quote, and Jeff really works along those lines. So, but you know, it's not just Jeff Lemire. We're going to publish this book here in the spring by a guy named I'm blanking on his name right. It's called. I'm sorry, I'm completely tired right now.
You're talking about Tim Seaver?
Yeah, Tim Seaver's That Salty Air, another book that touches on similar themes of isolation and a sense of place and just very, and it's, again, gorgeously drawn. So, you know, we've got a lot of new talent lined up as well as some of our VIP old school guys like Jeffrey Brown, who's just as prolific as ever.
I was wondering, do you notice yourselves gravitating towards a certain tone or a theme in different types of books, like as opposed to like the visual look of it or whatever? Is it like a certain type of story? Sometimes you might be a little bit more
well, I think
partial
that,
to.
You know, that we're talking about things that having heart to them is that, you know, there was a wave like in the undergrounds in the 70s where everything was really counter-revolution and so forth and fight the power. And then in the 80s, there was sort of this real nihilistic vein in comics and so
ironic,
forth.
Ironic, you know.
Yeah.
And in the late 90s, when the cartoonists were coming up with, you know, like Kachuk and Tom Horn and Craig Thompson and others, these guys had a real positive outlook on life.
Yeah.
And they were doing some big soul-searching and some also, you know, doing some very, taking on some very tough subjects, but they were doing it with a real joy of life and a positive sense of life. And those are the things that Brett and I really liked about. Also, we gravitated towards books that were real indie and had a lot of literary merit, but also could be extremely accessible to the masses, because we always felt that the comics industry was upside down, that what was called the mainstream was actually the subgenre of action-adventure comics,
mm-hmm.
called superheroes.
Oh, that's
and
true.
What was actually the left wing or the avant-garde was really the stuff that was more akin to film and literature and the real world and should appeal to the great majority of masses. And that's why when we put out like the graphic novel From Hell and its complete set and also Blankets, which was the largest graphic novel ever done, I think, without being serialized first. You know, Craig worked on it for 5 years, and then we decided to wait and put it out in one chunk. Those books had a real big effect on the book trade and the world at large, and contributing, not obviously taking credit for it, but contributing to people's awareness of graphic novels as a literary medium that could be taken seriously across the board.
I find that I totally agree with what you were saying about the comic industry basically shot itself in the foot, tried to appeal to fans for 25 years, and now we're trying to get, you know, comics back into like mom and pop stores where they were they used to be. And but what I really enjoy is stuff exactly like you were saying, like just that has that going for it. You know, something that's I work at a comic store, and when somebody comes in and goes, "I don't read comics, what should I look at?" I've got about 10 or 15 things that I can rack off the top of my head that are worth picking up instantly.
And guaranteed, they probably don't have capes.
Yeah. Yeah, guaranteed. Like, it's not, it's never anything that's like, it's a mainstream. But basically, it should be good. It shouldn't be a good superhero. It should be good.
Right.
You know?
Stand on its own. Independent of genre or whatever.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Now, one thing I'm really curious about, and I really want to get into further, is the Alan Moore aspect with some of the challenges of taking on really new. I don't want to say challenging work, but I guess
what's challenging?
The Lost Girls, as far as the process of putting that out, because that's one of your I think one of the big success stories for Top Shelf recently, like that and Blankets or so, what come to mind is like the bigger, you know, pieces of really launching.
The when Lost Girls came out, I think there was sort of this sort of like a low whisper about how good it would do. I think,
well, Lost Girls was an enormous gamble for us as a publishing house, but Brett and I have for 10 years been taking enormous gambles every year and doing things that where we're at the Vegas table going all in
yeah.
in baby
yeah.
all in, and I can't tell you how many times we've done that as a company and just barely gotten through and survived for another year or whatever. This is a very tough business.
Mm-hmm.
Lost Girls, on the other hand, was a difficult project because it had so many different elements in it. first of all, it's an absolute work of genius. It's one of the greatest, most novel graphic novels ever put out. And Alan and Melinda just did an amazing job with it. They spent 16 years on it creating a literary pornography, which is something that's really never been done before in visual form, and put challenged everybody to take a serious look at sexual issues and pornography and free speech issues and the difference between what takes place in your mind and what takes place in reality, and put it all out there on the table. And very few people have the social standing to be able to do something like right. that and actually pull it off, but Alan and Melinda did. But at the same time, it was one of those projects where it was difficult to tell if anybody would order it or not, if it would get seized or banned, or you know, you'd get arrested for publishing it or owning a copy or whatever, because we live in a crazy time where people are just overreacting to everything these mm-hmm. days. It's like a lynch mob culture we live in now, except they don't use nooses anymore. They just crucify you on TV and the internet,
yeah.
you know?
Or even worse, they ignore you.
So, and plus, Lost Girls, to be in the dream form that Melinda and Alan wanted it to be, which was oversized, cloth-bound books with dust jackets on archival paper, with beautiful inks and slip cases shrink-wrapped and all this, is an extremely expensive format. I mean, the printings on Lost Girls so far, if you can imagine, cost $650,000. Okay,
wow.
So for a small press publisher, those are...
Mm-hmm. That's
those
big
are,
money.
That's big money.
Yeah, I don't think they spent that much on the Love and Rocket reprints.
And so it was one of those. It was one of those big gambles. We worked it very hard from a PR point of view, not just to make sure the book would launch well, but also to make sure that we had a lot of friends and allies in big places, you know, like Publishers Weekly and all the big internet places and the magazines and radio stations, and a lot of key endorsements from, you know, powerful people, well-regarded people, so that everybody would know right away that this was a work of literature. It's packaged as one, it looks as one, it is one, and that it had the endorsements of the whole nation, so that it couldn't be argued with. If it ever came under attack, at least we'd know we would have our friends and it would cause a furor. And the fact that it was in the top 20 at Amazon.com's millions of products for a while, and Amazon.com sold, you know, thousands and thousands of copies of it, shows that it was accepted in America, you know, pretty right away. Even though there has been some legal troubles with the book over the Peter Pan copyright issue with the Gosh mm-hmm. Hospital in the UK, but which settled peacefully, and also in Canada, because Canadian law does not differentiate between real people and drawings sometimes.
Yes,
and,
yes.
The book actually could have been deemed illegal in Canada, but we presented our case to Canadian Customs, and they actually saw the literary value of the book and approved the book for importation, so that's why it's readily available in Canada now. But there was a lot of rough go there at the beginning, because we didn't know if Canada would ever accept the book or not.
Yeah, well, even at the store that I work at, we sold about 30 copies of it, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's not a very big store, but, you know, people were coming in looking for it.
Yeah.
And that was the Canadian aspect, being in the north, is especially appealing for us as far as interest, because really, especially with Diamond, they have a real reluctance of trying to ship anything to Canada that might be considered
questionable
content.
Yeah.
And really, like, going to the wall and basically pushing it to be put through to Canada. With Diamond, it was put in the actual Diamond catalog, right? Not the adult supplement?
Actually, both. Diamond was very kind to us and let us put it in both, because they viewed it as a literary book, an Alan Moore book as well, but they also knew it was an adult title, so they actually put it in both, which was unusual, but they did that for us. Mm.
I find that it can be a crutch for a lot of people whose products get deemed adult, and then they don't get ordered at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to Diamond's credit, Diamond has been pretty gun-shy with Canada in the past, because Canadian Customs has a reputation of seizing lots of things.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, they
and,
do.
And not allowing lots of things in. So the fact that they actually approved Lost Girls was a big boon for us and Diamond. But, you know, when Diamond ships over a bunch of stuff to Canada, it's very large shipments, you know. And the way the customs rules work, I mean, if they find one bad apple in the bunch, they can hold up the whole lot, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the reason that Diamond is cagey in a lot of times is because you have all those retailers in Canada, and if there's a book in there that Customs is hunting for, they're hot for right now, and then they seize and delay those shipments for weeks on end while legal battles are going, it could really hurt a lot of Canadian retailers not getting their products, not being able to sell their bread and butter books, you know.
Oh, yeah. That's,
So I understand why Diamond's sensitized to those importation issues, and that's why we try to work with them on these things to make them work, because we knew that Lost Girls was going to be such a high-profile book that it wasn't a book that was going to slip under the radar.
Yeah.
It was going to hit people straight in the face, you know, and it was going to be going to not people that bought porn, but just regular readers that wanted to read something quite fascinating. So it was going to be something of its own item.
You know? Yeah. Actually, I think that might be the first time I've ever heard of a publisher approaching Canada Customs and like before there's a problem with the book and showing them that it's worthy of having. I've never heard of that before, actually. That's a great move. You know?
Well, it cost a fortune, let me tell you.
Yeah.
As we had to hire a crack legal team to do it, and it wasn't cheap, but they did a very good job.
That's awesome.
There's a great Adam Egoyan movie, Exotica, with that basically spotlights the film censorship board and the hypocrisy of it. And it's... Yeah, we're not fans of the Canadian censorship thing, especially in Vancouver.
Yeah, I've been involved with the Little Sisters Gay and Lesbian Bookstore in town.
Yeah.
I've donated stuff to raise money for their legal battles with Canada Customs.
Too.
Yeah,
and we have too. We've sent the money before as well as supporters as well. And yeah, I mean the idea of banning books is bad in general, and it doesn't matter how shocking anything is. A year or two later, it's not shocking anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and it's information can't be bad, you know.
And the
what you do with it, it's not the information.
The ironic part in most of it is up until a couple of years ago, almost all the comics were printed in Canada anyways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we still print most of ours in Val-d'Or, so.
Yeah, we print a lot of our books in Canada at Le Bon Enfant. They do a great job, and so we do a lot of business in Canada.
I think... if it's not Canada, it's Malaysia now, with all the fancy books and stuff. So, little background info is, what got you guys into comics, each of you?
Chris, you want to go first?
I guess, you know, I wasn't into comics when I was a kid. I was actually a musician my whole life. But to look at me now, you would hard pressed to believe it, but throughout the 80s, I was a heavy metal lead guitar player playing in bands and stuff.
It's true.
So,
it's true. I'm trying to get him to post on the YouTube some of his old band stuff, like video footage of his band.
Yeah.
Oh, I'd be happy to post on the YouTube
site. I need to put out a DVD one of these days of old band tapes. That'd be funny. But so I never read comics as a kid. As a kid, I always thought that books with pictures in them were for little kids. My parents always told me books with just words in them were for big kids, you know. So I kept trying to read books like Dune and the Tolkien series at a very early age and move on to books, you know. I discovered comics in my 30s. By just being bored one day and having an hour to kill, and saw a comic book store and walked in and asked what adults should be reading, and they put a copy of V for Vendetta in my hands, the graphic novel. And I read that, and that was my very first comic book, and it absolutely blew me away. I had that epiphany that I had when I heard my first Black Sabbath album when I was 13, you know, which was, I could do this, you know. And I just decided to get involved. I didn't know how I was going to get involved in comics, but I thought, I'll just get involved. And so I just started reading everything I could get my hands on and taking notes, and eventually that turned into the zine, and that turned into meeting Brett and turned into being a publisher. So that's my story. Brett, how about you, man?
Oh, I'm a little more old school. I was definitely a fanboy. Started as a real youngster reading, like, Richie Rich and Casper the Ghost and stuff like that. And then... a superhero comic here and there, and then a Spinner Rack at Plaid Pantry when I was just a chubby 14-year-old dorkhead, and discovered three books that I called the Holy Trinity. They just hooked me for life. That was Frank Miller's Daredevil, of course the Chris Claremont John Byrne X-Men,
yeah,
and then the Wolfman Perez, Teen Titans.
Yeah, those are the big three.
Big three, and yeah. I was 14. It was like, you know, I was the right age for Star Wars. I was 12 when Star Wars came out and just blew my brain, and I was 11. And then same thing with those comics. I was just the right age, and, I became an addict, Marvel Zombie at first, but I was an addict. Played that out into my college years, and was still addicted, but the product sucked.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really restless and, like, kind of sketchy because I had some really bad stuff cut into my junk.
Who put this Rob Liefeld in here? It's like an air bubble.
No, it's true. It's true. Like, X-Men, it's like Chris Claremont. What the hell happened to Chris Claremont on X-Men? But I was still buying it, you know?
Yeah.
And then I was in this really, really horrible comic book shop a block from campus at University of Oregon, which you would, this is an aside, but you'd think that a college campus and a hippy-dippy liberal college would have a great indie comic selection.
Yeah.
No dice. But he happened to have just a smattering of things, and I found, I think it was like issue 9 of Hate. It was the one with Stinky on the cover, surrounded by a bunch of people.
I scream, you scream, we all scream for heroin.
I think that's it, yeah. And then an issue of 8-Ball. I can't remember which one. There was like one of the early issues of the...
The Velvet Glove?
No, the 8-Ball was probably around, I don't know, issue 12 or something.
Okay.
And then I discovered the John and Cordy anthology. And then the big daddy that just blew my brain was Rubber Blanket with a 3-issue series that David Mazzucchelli did.
I was just going to say that when you said the Drawn and Quarterly, that's that the first time I read the David Mazzucchelli one where he was the story about the guy in Paris. I was like, I was blown away, and then I had to hunt down all the Rubber Blankets.
Yeah, and you know that was such a revelation to me, and like virtually overnight, I canceled my X-Men subscription. And then there was another, at the time, there was a kind of an anarchist bookstore in Eugene called Hungry Head, and he's kind of like the big zinester carrier of Eugene, and, you know, had a lot of the mini comics and stuff like this that I didn't even know existed. I'm like, whoa, like, and that's where I discovered Tom Hart and James Kachaka and Jason Lutz and early Ed Brubaker, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I've never let go of my mainstream roots. I still love good contemporary superhero comics.
If they're good, they're good. It doesn't matter.
It's good, yeah. But you know, by and large, as a aspiring publisher, it was definitely the indie stuff that appealed to me. And I really have no desire to be an assembly line publisher. So anyway, that's my story.
Is that something important for both of you? Is keeping it at a certain volume of work that you both can still be really active in what you're putting out?
Yeah, well, I mean, there is a certain limit to what we can do anyway, because Top Shelf is just 3.5 people right now. For the longest time, it was 2, and then we were lucky to get Robert Venditti to work for us full-time, who's helped us be a lot more productive. He also was the writer of our sci-fi book, The Surrogates, which has, you know, been real popular for us, too, and just scored a movie deal with Disney, so that's off and running to be big things. And
Mazel tov.
And then we just hired a part-time kid right out of college named Lee Walton on Portland, Oregon to help us as well. But, you know, with just being 3.5 guys and putting out, we average about 20 to 25 new books a year and about 15 reprints a year. So we're putting out 40 books a year, traveling to 21 conventions and handling all of that with just basically the three of us. So that's quite a bit. So that's limiting, and that means that Brett and I have to be choosy about what we do in a given year and stick to those 20 projects and push those.
What would for someone that thinks that they fit the Top Shelf mold or the lack of mold, I don't know, because it's a pretty diverse selection of stuff, what would be a process for them to kind of get your guys' attention other than throwing comics at you at a con?
I'll take this one, Chris. Two words: make comics.
You hear that, Don?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you would be astounded how many times people come to us and say, "Oh, I've got this great idea for a comic." Well, shut up and show me. You know, and the truth is, and another piece of advice I give constantly in email feedback is, you know, hey, you show a lot of promise, blah 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 blah. Your stuff's pretty good. Your art needs a little bit of work. But, hey, that's nothing that drawing 500 more pages of comics won't fix. And it either freaks people out or they go, God, yeah, you know what? He's right. And I always tell people, hey, compare yourself to your favorite cartoonist. Really, be be objective.
Be critical.
Yeah, be self-critical and compare yourself to your favorite cartoonist. Are you even close to them? And, you know, and if the answer is no, then you're not really, you're really not ready yet, you know. And you,
yeah, and a lot of times what the young cartoonists don't realize is that we are competing with the best things out there. We're competing with Elvis and the Beatles and the biggest, most famous authors to try and get people to buy our books. And when people actually buy our books in a Barnes & Noble and Borders or a comic book shop, we've outcompete Frank Miller and everybody else that day and Brad Pitt's DVDs for their entertainment dollar, you know. Mm-hmm. So we have to have things that are of that quality and of that design ability. And Brad is right, you know, make comics. That a lot of people submit to us blind things that they are doing, and we get, I guess, 1,000 or more submissions a year. That's three or four a day every single day. And obviously, if we're only publishing 20 projects a year, you know, we're not going to be pulling a lot out of that stack. Every once in a while it happens, maybe one a year, one every other year comes out of that stack. But most people are actually putting things out, putting mini comics out, working the convention circuit, getting some feedback, putting something else out. So you not only get to know that their work and see it grow, but you get to meet them, decide whether you like them or not, see whether they're actually good at helping to promote their own work. And when you end up signing with somebody, you've actually established a relationship with them and say, okay, let's work together to get your next project out there. So we tend to end up signing people more from that latter process of people who have made things, gotten some stuff out there, even if it's just a mini comic form, you know, showed some interest in each other and developed that into projects.
Yeah.
And you know, another thing too is that I just kind of realized too is that, you know, if I see that you've been making comics for 3 years, 4 years, or whatever, and I see you at the shows, and I'm buying your mini comics, and I see a growth curve, what that says to me is that you're dedicated and you really have, you know, either career aspirations or at least you're very, very dedicated at this time. And one thing, you know, another thing that in this crazy marketplace that we deal with is, you know, the sad reality is that, like, a brilliant comic that's a one-shot is going to might have a shelf life of X, but it's the people who are continuously doing new work,
mm-hmm,
who are the ones who really develop an audience. It's almost like if we know that this is a one-time thing, it's kind of a loss leader in that there's not going to be any kind of follow-up for it. It's like a band that comes out with a killer album, and then 8 years later there's still nothing else. Well, they've died, you know.
Pulling a My Bloody Valentine.
Yeah, you want to. You've got, it's the cartoonists who show a commitment to producing through their own work, self-publishing, and that's when Chris and I go, God, these guys are really dedicated, you know. And let's get on this thing.
Yeah, I also noticed it's like it's like basically they have to do the work too. They can't just come to you with a project, like something that they've done, and then you do all the work marketing it, and you do all the work. It's like they have to keep work. Like, it's, I think sometimes people forget it's work to make comic
really,
books.
It truly, truly is. And along those same lines too, you know, we're really trying to involve, partially because we're only 3.5 men, like Chris said, but it's just the reality of the business. We're trying to involve the creators now in as much as we can in the marketing and promotion of the work. Like, give me your ideas, you know, because there's so much competition. You don't even realize how hard it is to make a comic book sell more than a few thousand copies.
Mm-hmm.
And so when a cartoonist shows that willingness to get out there and work on that aspect as well, besides just doing the hard work of sitting behind a desk and making the comics, if they're willing to get out there and pimp their stuff as well, that goes a long way. Yeah. Long way.
I just read the Darwin Cook interview in the Comics Journal, and he was almost reiterating the same thing where he said for an artist to find a style, he has to just keep putting out work whether he likes it or not, and keep working on it.
Being a cartoonist is an extremely difficult thing because it's not just being a good illustrator, it's being a good storyteller, and then also being a good writer. And those things, there's so much to internalize to be all those things at the same time. If you're a writer, you have it half as easy. If you're just an illustrator, you have it half as easy or more. To be a cartoonist, it takes an enormous amount of work. So the only way to do that is to keep telling stories, keep getting work out there, because the truth is not very many people come out of the womb fully formed as a cartoonist. You have to tell 5 or 6 stories. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I, I'm a guitar player, so it's the same thing. Like the first day you pick up the guitar, you're still trying to line up your left hand with your right hand on the same string, you know.
Yeah.
And I eventually that just becomes so internalized, it's difficult to even talk about it. You know,
but there's no cartoonist comes out of the bat fully realized.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at old Dan Clowes. If you've ever seen really, really old Dan.
I've got a copy of Psycho Number 1 at home.
Yeah, it's really not that great.
No.
And here he is. You know, arguably, I think, the greatest living cartoonist on the
You know the funny thing about that comic, though? The Rick Coulter got? It all looks exactly the same.
Oh, it got quiet there. Actually, I was going to say that you, like, one of the points that you guys kind of are touching on that I was thinking is I was thinking that, like, all arts, like, you know, whether it's dance or music or painting or singing or whatever, it's they're all easy to do poorly and not easy to do well.
Yeah.
And I think because comics, the historically in North America, since comics are made for kids or even children's books, now we're having this deluge of people that think, oh, I can't write a novel, I can't write a movie, I can't direct a movie, I'll make a comic book or I'll make a children's book. And it's just tiring, because you could see that that's their mindset, is that this is easy, you know?
I'm of two minds of that. Part of me is very excited by that, because in schools, I think it's great, you know, for any like fourth graders, okay, we're going to make a comic book, you know, and I think it's great to show kids that
they can
don't
do
have
it.
To have a lot of money to make cool little to tell their own stories. But yeah, I totally agree. Like, especially when I got started like a decade ago, this was before like the blogosphere, mm-hmm. when zines were print, not online. And there was this attitude of, hey, let's make a zine. It's like, just because you can go to Kinko's doesn't mean you should.
Yeah.
Put down the photocopy.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a zine festival here last year, and a couple of us were making jokes that they have these workshops all day about how to do bookbinding or how to make your own paper and all that. And after walking around and looked at stuff, I said they had to have some workshops on how to staple pages together, you know,
lined up,
line them up, you know, how to make a legible zine.
Yeah.
you know
Oh, Don.
Oh,
nothing but love from Don King.
Well, zines, you know, anyway.
The nice thing about the comic book industry is that it is set up for people to come in and just do their own thing. It's very welcoming that way. Where if you look at like prose novels or something, and you go to a fair and somebody has self-published their own prose book, immediately everybody thinks, oh my God, this guy is ridiculous, you know.
Yeah.
But in comics, you can come to a little convention and set up with your minis, and if you got a little something with a little flair to it, immediately you're accepted in the community, and you can actually start a career that way. So this is a industry that puts a badge of honor on self-publishing and doing your own thing and getting out there, and it is very zine culture-like in that regard. And I think that's a good thing, because a lot of us have ideas, but until you are willing to just get it out there, have that blinding flash of the obvious that you could actually do this and make something, you know, and put it out there, that's the thing. I mean, my first zine, the Star Support number one, is so god-awfully embarrassing. Thank God there's only 40 copies floating around. But you know what? If I hadn't have said I'm going to put a zine out, I wouldn't have ever done anything. That was the stepping stone to Lost Girls and the Blankets and the From Hell books, which Brett and I are extremely proud of having a hand in. And so, you know, everybody should just get out there and do something. And then it's just a matter of whether you want to keep doing more things. The first thing you do is not the be-all, end-all of creativity. That's the thing. Have the confidence to get something out there and the humility to know the next thing you do is going to be a lot better.
Yeah, I think putting up my first comic that looked really crappy actually makes me make more of an effort now, because I now I have to live with that.
Yeah.
You know, because there's copies laying around somewhere that someone has. I'm not gonna embarrass myself again.
Don, that would have to mean you do comics. It's okay. Nothing but love on the Inksud Show. We're running about 5 minutes left with you folks.
I was gonna mention one of the newest books that you guys put out, the Super Spy. I love that book. I thought it was just awesome.
I'm so happy to hear you say that. Matt Kent, we have been a huge fans of Matt Kent from the get-go, when he did Mephisto and Pistol Whip and Pistol Whip the Yellow Menace with writer Jason Hall, and I knew that he and Jason were just a creative force to be reckoned with. They were one of those blind submissions in the pile that
one
both Brett
thousand.
And I got, and we were so blown away by these guys we'd never heard of. We signed them on the spot. That's one of those rare cases where they came out of the womb fully formed, and they are just amazing. And Matt kind of went solo with Two Sisters afterwards and then Super Spy, and we have been baffled by the fact that Matt has not taken off as one of the major cartoonist talents out there in the industry these last few years that we've been pushing his book. And lo and behold, Super Spy finally comes out this year, and everybody gets
it. Like,
they
a lot of people are
love
saying,
it.
It's so great to see Eisner, and that's good.
Yeah. When I saw it, I mean, I picked that as one of my we did a show a couple weeks ago about like what our favorite comics were that came out in the last year, and that was one of the ones I picked because I thought it was I was actually a little bit like looking at it, I didn't know how to take it at first just because the title and the look of it was not what I was expecting, and it was just fantastic.
Matt is one of the most astounding graphic designers that I've ever seen too, and that's a huge part of what makes that book sing. I mean, the sheer bravado of the design, the package is just it's astounding.
Well, and also the fact that the book is about spies in Germany and France and Spain and World War II, and it's got all that espionage stuff down in spades and the secret codes and the double-crossing and the things told very Tarantino-esque where people that were alive in one scene are now dead and alive again because it's told out of sequence. So and all these spies' paths cross each other. But the added power of his books is that these six spies that he follows, their different paths in Super Spy, he's really talking about the longing within them for their own humanity and for their own ability to find love and happiness in their lives, and how spying doesn't necessarily help them in that regard, or it makes life more complicated for them. And I think everybody can sort of relate to it on that level, is everything we do in life, we are busy doing, but we're also trying to find happiness and love and all these things, and those things are very elusive a lot of times, and it's a great allegory in that regard.
It's also one of those books that you were mentioning earlier about like, this is a general audience book, if there ever was one. It's just like great spy stories. You know, it's just, I loved it. I thought it was one of the ones I recommended to a few people. We sold out of them right away because I was like, you got to read this. You know, it's
and
just
interesting enough. I mean, it's very rarely do foreign editions of our books get licensed almost immediately, unless they're really high profile ones like Craig's or, you know, Allen's and things of that nature. But Super Spy came out, and I guess because of the spy theme in Europe, I mean, the about five European editions got snatched up almost immediately because everybody really loved the book so much. I'm so glad to hear you say that because that is just so refreshing to see Matt's book just take off like this.
Yeah, like Chris said too, like we, you know, Matt's a guy who his work just in the past hasn't sold particularly well, and I, you know, part of it's our lack of marketing muscle maybe, but for whatever reason he's never caught, and you know, In some cases, you know, that's a situation where, well, we're gonna have to let this guy go. But with Matt, we're like, God, no, he's too good. This guy is brilliant. We have to keep up with him. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a book that could be the one that breaks him out. So
yeah,
I hope so.
So, what are some books we can look forward to from Top Shelf? I know there's a Martial Law omnibus that's got me sweating in the hands.
Yeah, well, that, you know, obviously League 3 and Martial Law and Alan Moore's bumper book of magic, and these things are going to be coming down the pike in 2009. Also, a new book from Craig Thompson called Kissy Poo Garden is going to be coming as well. But, you know, and just in general for next year, we've got a lot more of our kids' stuff, you know, like with Owlie and Corgi and two new books, Yam by Corey Barba and Johnny Boo by James Kachaka. We really have done a huge push into our all-ages line the last few years. Because, you know, like in 97 to 2000, once the book trade started discovering graphic novels, we did a big push to try and make people understand that comics were literary and that, you know, they were for adults, you know. And every article around 2000 was biff, pam, boom, comics aren't for kids anymore.
No, that still annoys the hell out of me. It happens every once in a while.
Yeah, when, mostly the journalists have grown up now, and now they're talking about, they're just accepting graphic novels as a literary thing, and you don't have to explain graphic novels to people as much as you used to. But around 2002, 2003, a lot of the publishers realized we had sort of forgotten the kids in our effort to really get people to take comics seriously. And so Brett and I did did a big search for books that would appeal to kids, and Owlie and Spiralbound and Pinky and Stinky and some of these other books and Corgi have come out of that and become a real big, strong part of our line. So that's, there'll be some big releases next year along those lines as well.
We also have a ton of stuff that's in progress. You know, there's a long time coming Brian Ralph book that we're doing. We're doing a Brian Wood book that's stopped and started and stopped and started. We're doing a collection of Kagan McLeod's Infinite Kung Fu at some point. We're doing this book with Ray Fox and Chris helping
Vince
out.
Vince Locke called Junction True, which
yeah, Vincent,
is absolutely
Locke,
beautiful. That's going to
you know, a lot of stuff that's in progress that's we're not really exactly sure when it's going to be done, but, man, when these things do get done, they're going to be amazing. So.
And you have a book coming out, too, don't you, Chris?
Yeah, the yearbook stories, 1976, 1978, which are two stories I wrote a long time ago, which appeared in some early issues of the Small Press Expo anthologies, really personal stories. Of one was running for student body president in high school, which is kind of an interesting story. One of my great beer anecdotes I give sometimes at a bar. And then one of my first big rock and roll gigs when my first band, which is a bizarre story of ending up playing for the Hell's Angels. And so Rich Tomasso and Bo Hampton illustrated both of those. And this is a little 32-page comic coming out, debuting at the SPX. And Matt Kent did the design work on it, and it is beautiful. It looks like my old high school yearbook with photos of me from when I was 15 and 16 in there. So it's horrifically embarrassing.
Yeah, we're all looking forward to that.
That's when he had hair and, you know, stuff like that.
Back when I had hair, that's true. And a mustachio, too. God.
Nice and waxed. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for taking the time out of your day.
Well, thanks for having us, man. This is very cool.
I'll see you on Saturday, Brett.
Okay, we'll see you there.
And unfortunately, I won't make it to SPX because, well, I'm a broke student. So y'all have a good time.
Yeah, okay. Take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Thanks, guys. Bye. That was Chris Daros and Brett Warnock, publishers of Top Shelf Books, and tons of great comics coming out from them.
And they're available at any good bookstore in town. We'll have Top Shelf Books. You can check Lucky's, or you can check Sophia's or RX Comics on Main Street.
If you want to deal with that grumpy guy.
Yeah, me. And it's Top Shelf is one of the best publishers in North America, like for comic related material. It's unbelievable, and they're the ones, you know, they put out a mix of everything. It's just fantastic.
A smorgasbord of comics.
Yes, and check out Super Spy. That's a great book.
Just for some let you know about some events. Tomorrow night at Lucky's Comics, there will be a book launch for True Loves 2. Brian Fukushima's Job Goblin and Fred Grissom's latest hate song, as well as one other book, which I can't remember right now.
Yeah, and I was going to mention that there's going to be another Vancouver Comic Con on November 4th. It's the first Sunday of the month.
Derek Kirk Kim will be the special guest.
Yeah, Derek Kirk Kim will be the special guest. And actually going on right now at the Japanese-Canadian Cultural Center in Burnaby is a manga art show, which is really interesting, and they have original artwork. I went and checked it out on opening night, and they've got stuff by Clamp and stuff by...
Tezuka.
Osamu Tezuka. It's just gorgeous, and... It's not hard to find. It's a little hard to find, but you just look it up.
There we go.
Yeah.
And don't forget Sunday, if you feel like wearing a rain jacket, will be Word on the Street, including the small press part, which will have Don and Colin Upton, Robin Bougie, and all sorts of other local folks there selling their wares. They'll be outside the post office cross street from the library, because as we all know, Sam Sullivan is a poo head who doesn't know how to settle a strike worth a damn.
Yeah, and so come up and say hi at the Word on the Street. Word under the street, that's not under the street this
word
year.
Word at the library, we'll call it.
Yeah.
Or at the post office.
Yeah.
Okay, so Ink Studs, next week my guest will be Nick Abastaz. Week after that will be Rod Philbrandt, who's one of the regular contributors to Georgia Strait. As well, the next 2 weeks I will be having special things. It's the fun drive here at CITR, and I will have books to give away. Not give away, but you make money pledges and get books and stuff, because, you know, I don't have advertising in the show, as you may have noticed, so CITR's got to make some money to pay for, you know, to work.
We could take payola, though, if you actually have a business you want to promote. Maybe we can take a couple of bucks and just name it.
Don. No, no.
Look what they did to Alan Freed.
On that note, I bid you adieu. Up next, Crimes and Treasons.
Go.
Listen, radio is an important means of communicating 3,000 years of